This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Earlier this week, The Mountaintop, a play that made serious ripples on Broadway, opened for a month-long run at the Booth Playhouse. The play takes place in the Lorraine Motel Room of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and reimagines his last night on Earth. We get a preview later in the program. First, Russia is shining brightly in a worldwide spotlight. Although competition actually began last night, tonight the world will be treated to the usual spectacle surrounding the opening of the 22nd Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia. It's an event during which host countries pull out all the stops in an effort to wow the rest of the world. For those of us in the United States, it comes at a time when that nation can use some good PR in our eyes. Relations between our two countries appear tense. We disagree on several things, and there seems to be a little love lost between Vladimir Putin and Barack Obama. On top of that, Russia is giving sanctuary to a very controversial American, Edward Snowden. With all that in mind, we welcome to our program the Russian ambassador to the United States to talk about all of these things and more. Sergei Ivanovich Kislyak has been Russia's ambassador to this country since 2008, and he joins us under the auspices of the World Affairs Council in Charlotte in a conversation we recorded last week. Welcome to Charlotte. Welcome to our program.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
If the Olympics goes off without a hitch, and we pray that it does, what is Russia hoping that the world sees as we watch from on television from around the world?
First of all, it's going to be a wonderful opportunity for youngsters from all over the world to get together for a high day of competitions, friendship, and it's an event to be enjoyed, and I am absolutely sure that it's going to be enjoyed by those who happen to be in Sochi, who are lucky to be in Sochi, and by the rest of the world.
From what I know very little about Sochi, although I'm sure I'll find out a lot about it in the next several weeks. It's said to be an unlikely spot for a Winter Olympics. Is it in your mind?
Not exactly, because Sochi is pretty unique geographically. It's a resort area on a warm sea that is called Black Sea. It's pretty unique because you can drive for 2 hours in the mountains and can downhill skiing there. So Olympics will be done. Competitions are organized both in stadiums downside and the competitions in the mountains. So there is a lot of snow, and the conditions there are very good for the Olympics.
Of course, the big concern on the world stage is the threat of terrorism. And it's a threat in our country with the Super Bowl. So this is not something that's particular to Russia, but there is this threat during the Sochi Games. And President Putin has said that he has erected a ring of steel around Sochi. And because these games are so important to Russia and so important to President Putin, and they're in an area of your country that is volatile at the moment, that makes these games an even more attractive target, it seems to me, for terrorists. How confident are you that this ring of steel will hold and that the Olympics will go on without a hitch?
First, terrorism and the threat of terrorism is a global phenomenon. And you have to take it seriously, whether you are in Russia, in the United States, or elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And we are taking it seriously. So does American government, and you referred to Super Bowl, and I was watching the preparations for the Super Bowl and the kind of security measures that are being undertaken here in the United States. And I thought that it was a responsible move to make, and you are rather away from what is considered to be more volatile regions. Russia is not that volatile, as you have said, or sometimes is described in the press. We are rather stable and self-reassured country, and we know how to deal with the terrorists.
Well, I don't mean to say that Russia is volatile, because
right.
It certainly isn't volatile.
No,
in an interview you did with CNN's Candy Crowley, she pointed out that Sochi is located kind of next door to a war zone. And
there is no war zone, and I said to Candy this, and I will repeat it to you.
Okay.
There is no war zone. You need to give a proper reporting about what it is and what is also important, what it is not.
What is it?
It's Sochi is a wonderful, peaceful resort area, and in the mountains of Caucasus. And it has always been used by Russians for spending vacations there. By the way, because of the geography, it's one of the few places where Russians can go to enjoy warm climate and the warm sea in the territory of their own country. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they have to go to Turkey, to Dominican Republic, to enjoy sunshine and warm sea. So what we've done in Sochi is not only to show off Russia for international audience. It's most probably one of important considerations to make because we want people to understand what Russia is and what Russia is not. And the Olympics is certainly a wonderful opportunity. But the reason why we want it done is that we are investing into the region that will become even greater place for Russians to use after the Olympics completed as a huge area where they can do downhill skiing, swim in the warm sea, enjoy biathlon competitions, and everything else within their own country.
But you have some terrorist enemies, as we do as well, but you have some terrorist enemies who are seeing this Olympics, and they're seeing it as a place to really do damage to Russia's image and to kill people. Talk about this ring of steel that President Putin has put up around this city. 40,000 troops deployed in and around Sochi. That's more than 10% of the city's population. But what about the rumors that we hear of so-called Black Widow terrorists who have already penetrated the ring? They're inside the ring. What do you do? How do you know it's going to work? How do you know?
I know it's going to work because the level of importance that we attach to this and level of or the amount of efforts that have been invested in security of Sochi. And we do not leave anything for chances. And all these rumors are rumors. Mm-hmm. And there is no information that will prove that it's true.
Except there was that explosion in that train station a couple of weeks ago.
It was, and explosions occurred not only in that region. So you need to remember that terrorism is a global phenomenon, and we all have to take it seriously. But Sochi would be as safe as any place in the world during Olympics.
The United States offered to work together with Russia on Olympic safety and on security. Did you take us up on the offer, or do you need our help?
Well, first of all, we conduct Olympics in Russia. So the security measures are taken by Russia. And we are responsible people. And first and foremost, you need to remember that majority of people who would go to the Olympics to watch the games are Russians. And they go there simply and are self-reassured. They know that the measures that are being taken are quite efficient and they will be safe.
This is reportedly the most expensive Olympic Games ever in history. Time magazine reports that $50 billion has been spent. And we are told that some of the expense has been due to corruption. And nations vie for these games. They embark on massive building campaigns. It's happening in South America right now with the Summer Olympics. Occasionally, they displace people, their residences, businesses have to be torn down because of the venues that have to be built. What makes it worth it?
As I said, for us, all these investment is not only about the games. The games are an important stimulus, I would say, for Russians to invest in the region. And the games will be over, but all the buildings, about 40,000 additional rooms in hotels, are going to stay. And they will be available for Russians to enjoy a fantastic environment in this area. And we had to rebuild the infrastructure in the region, to modernize railroads, to make it more reliable in terms of energy supplies. I read somewhere that today, as a result of these measures, even the environment has already improved in this particular area.
How so?
Huh?
How so?
Because of employment of cleaner technologies and everything else. And that works pretty well in order to develop the region. And most probably, if not for the Olympics, we would wait for years and years in order to create an environment where not only the government, but also private business invests into the region. Mind you, the government spends less than half of this investment. The rest of it is investment by businesses, an investment that they expect is going to return.
What has been the expense? As I said, Time magazine reported $50 billion. There's some discussion over whether that's exactly true, and I think Russia disputes that.
Well, no. The president of Russia said that it's 200 billion rubles. So,
which is $7 billion.
Why?
Well, he said it was 214 billion rubles, or about $7 billion.
I'm not sure that
the calculation. We don't have time to do the math here,
right.
The conversion. Dmitry Medvedev, who's the former president, now prime minister, right, told CNN that the $50 billion figure is accurate.
That's about the figures that I gave to you.
Okay, all right. Because at some point, Mr. Putin said that's not true, but that it doesn't matter. Does it fascinate you that people outside of Russia care how much it costs you?
I'm disappointed that they care about it more than about the Olympics themselves,
yeah,
about the competition, about the chances for American team to compete with ours.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that fascinates me, and I guess it's politics and it's international politics, but there are critics who say that Mr. Putin's figures on what this Olympic Games is costing Russia are only one-tenth of the actual expense, and they say that the Games are Mr. Putin's unaffordable personal vanity project intended to cement his legacy as the driving force of the country's restoration. And even the president has called them Games, I believe, his baby. Are they important? Is the success of these games important domestically, more so than internationally?
The success of the games is important for any country that holds them. It's a big event. You have about 100 countries sending their delegations to your place, and you want it to be successful. You want it to be joyful, and you want people to get back to the homes with good remembrance about my country. And we are not exception in these terms. When it comes to all the speculation as to what it is to my president, I would say that he has already established a legacy that is going to be long-lasting, and it's very positive. So he doesn't need Olympics for that. If you ask me whether he, the president, is attached to the Olympics, but of course, for several reasons. One is it's a huge project, and it's a huge project, and I would have to repeat it because many people miss the point. Olympic construction projects, it's not only about Olympics. It's about reinvigorating a whole region that is so important to us because we have few resorts with that kind of opportunities for Russians to enjoy because of the climate conditions. And this massive investment into the region will create an absolutely different environment for us there. So the president is attached to this part of the Sochi Olympics, even, I don't know, more or less, but very, very attached to this part of Olympics as well. Plus, he's known to be a good sportsman himself.
Yes, he is.
And he plays, currently he enjoys playing hockey among the amateurs, and he's pretty good at that.
Sergei Ivanovich Kislyak is the Russian ambassador to the United States. We will continue our conversation and talk about things other than the Olympics when we come back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley Arendt Bolt Cummings LLP, a full-service law firm serving the construction industry in Charlotte and throughout the nation, partnering with clients through all phases of a project. Details at babc.com. Well, around the time of the American Revolution, a man that you probably have never heard of, maybe never heard of, Prince Hall, helped to found an organization that continues to this very day. Prince Hall is considered the father of black masonry, and he's had a major impact on African Americans for over 200 years. There are 10,000 Prince Hall Masons just in our state alone. So the question becomes, how have they lasted? How do they differ from other Masonic organizations, and why are they still separate? We find out more about that and about the man himself Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, the Farm Bill passes Congress after a two-year standoff. CVS says it will stop selling tobacco products this fall. And the Labor Department releases its January jobs report.
Join the Diane Rehm Show for the News Roundup this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Sergei Ivanovich Kislyak. He's the Russian ambassador to the United States. We have him on the eve of the Olympics, thanks to the World Affairs Council of Charlotte. But there are other things to talk about other than the Olympics. We have a pretty large, I'm told, Russian community within Charlotte who are thrilled that you are paying us a visit. Is this your first time here?
Actually, it's my second. The first time it was for the Democratic Party convention. Mm-hmm. But that was very intense a program. I didn't have a chance to enjoy Charlotte proper.
Let's talk a little bit about Edward Snowden. Why are you giving him asylum in Russia?
Oh, it's very simple. You know, Mr. Snowden was flying from Hong Kong to some destination in Latin America through Russia. So when he was landing in Russia, we learned and he learned that his passport was revoked. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't continue his travel because not a single airline will be able to provide him a seat. So he got stuck because he wasn't going to Russia. So he didn't have a visa, nothing to enter Russia. Mm-hmm. And he didn't have a chance to continue his travel. So he was kind of in between countries. So it continued for almost a month, and we decided to give him permission to leave temporary in Russia, almost for humanitarian reasons.
How long is temporary?
This time it was for 1 year.
Mm-hmm. And what happens at the end of the year?
I don't know. And I don't know his plans.
Why?
But I also would like to add something that is important, that there were a lot of discussions of whether Russia can extradite him to the United States or not on the request of the U.S. government. And I would like to say that we do not have an extradition agreement with the United States. And it's something that is still missing in the framework of legal relations between our two countries. Mm-hmm. So there is no legal grounds, no legal basis on which any official in Russia could send him away. And he hasn't violated a single Russian law.
Okay.
He is a free man coming to Russia, and he continues to be a free man.
I guess the question is, even though we don't have an extradition agreement between our two countries, tensions are not— there are tensions between our two nations, and doesn't this exacerbate those tensions? And why would Russia take on this in the face of those tensions being elevated by the fact that you're giving him asylum? Why do it?
First of all, tensions are not invited by Russia because we didn't create the situation. It's rather our American friends who helped to create the situation. Secondly, we didn't mean to create tensions, but you are legally minding a country, and you might appreciate that even because of the risk of some tension, any official in Russia cannot overstep the law. And unless you have an agreement, what would be the legal ground to do so?
What is he doing? I mean, he's there as a guest in your country for a year at least. Who's paying the freight? Where is he living? Who's paying for his food, his apartment, his clothes?
I don't know.
You don't know?
No. Because he is a free man. He lives his own life. And he is entitled to to work at any facility that will be willing in his services.
Is he working?
I don't know.
Are you benefiting from the material that he took from the NSA?
No.
How do you know?
As much as anybody else, because it's published in the press.
I said in the beginning there doesn't seem to be much love lost between Vladimir Putin and Barack Obama. Is that a misstatement?
Misstatement. And I think that the relations and the kind of dialogue between the two presidents is much better than the press gives us credit for, because they focus on issues. issues that are important for Russia and the United States. It's not about love between politicians. It's about interest.
So how would you describe relationships right now between the Russian Federation and the U.S.?
I would describe them as practical, much better and much more focused on issues than people sometimes realize. We work on a number of issues together, even having some disagreements on positions and substance. I'll give you a couple of examples that are in the press each and every day. Syria and chemical weapons. If it wasn't for U.S. and Russia, we would never have a commitment by Syrians to dispense with these weapons. We would never have an international community helping this process. Even on political solution in Syria, we came to the understanding, when I say we, I mean U.S. and Russia, came to the understanding that the only solution to the Syrian crisis would be through political dialogue, having quite different assessments as who is right, who is wrong in the area. But what is important, we have been able to agree that political dialogue need to be pursued, and we do work diligently together each and every day in order to make it happen.
Well, Russia is credited with bringing the Assad regime to the negotiating table in Geneva. As you said, it wouldn't have happened had it not been for you. You seem to have a much better relationship with Assad than the United States. Are we on the same page, our two countries, with regard to Syria?
No. But we are on the same page on understanding that the issue of the future of Syria has to be resolved by the Syrians themselves. There is no other solution. You cannot bring a solution from outside. What is the best solutions for the Syrian to choose? Most probably we wouldn't share the same, exactly the same positions. But what is important, that it's neither you nor us will have to define what the future of Syrians is going to be.
Are we looking at Mr. Assad the wrong way? Do you see him the same way we see him? We see him evidently as a mass murderer and a international war criminal. Do you see him that way?
Well, I see Mr. Assad as a constitutionally elected president.
Really?
Yeah, of course.
Really?
Of course he was elected. He was. And I would like to say that the view as to who is to blame for the current killings is very different in Syria itself. Sometimes here you read the press about Syria's situation as if all of the country is against the president, which is not the case. The country is divided, whether it's 50-50 or somewhat around this. I don't know. What is important? That the killings have happened on both sides.
But he used chemical weapons.
That I'm not sure, because somebody must have used these weapons because there are evidence. We also found some, but we presented all our data to the United Nations in proper fashion, and we are very much concerned that it wasn't the government but the other side. And so it's very simplistic a statement that he used chemical weapons without...
We believe that he did. And we believe that he...
But the problem with the United States is that if you believe, the rest need to take it for granted. It's not working for us, including on chemical weapons. You remember the arguments that we heard about your evidence that U.S., I'm almost quoting, the U.S. believes... The U.S. came to the conclusion, where is the data? You know, we insisted from day one that the whole issue needs to be considered by the international community. With due respect to your capabilities of investigating things outside of the United States, you are not the only one in the world that has that kind of...
That's what I'm getting at, because I think it's really interesting. We have these two major powers who have been at each other's throats for much of the 20th century and now into the 21st, and we see things in very different ways still, because you said that Mr. Assad was fairly elected. We would take issue with that.
We say constitutionally elected.
All right, well, we say that he used chemical weapons on his people. You take issue with that. How can two rational powers, governed by intelligent people, see things so differently?
Well, it's not the first time.
No, it's history.
And we need to learn to listen to each other a little bit more than we have done so far. And the kind of argument that we here in this country came to the conclusion, or we believe, and but the others need to accept it for the face value, it doesn't work.
But what is there to gain for Russia by essentially, in our view, and our, this is our point of view, and I'll grant you that this is our point of view, that right. You're propping up a dictator. What's in it for Russia to do that?
We are not propping up the dictator. What we are trying to defend is the ability of the Syrians to decide their destiny. You need to understand that U.S. is behind an ocean from the region. We live next by. We see the terrorists and thousands of volunteers to fight a legitimate regime in Syria, gathering in Syria. Are they going to fight for democracy in Syria? Do you believe that? Mm-hmm. They have plans that transcend Syria. They are working to establish a new caliphate.
Are we on the same page with regard to Iran? Because you're next door to Iran as well.
And, yes, we
are. And their ability to build a nuclear weapon. Are we on the same page there?
First of all, they do not have this ability today, first. Secondly, we have been trying to work together within a format 5+1 with Iran. And I'm a little bit more reassured today that we are on, if not the same, on closer pages working on Iranian nuclear program. Moreover, Americans have become more active participants of this format, which we like very much. We also have a common position on the way that future arrangement can be negotiated. We have a position that was adopted by 5+1 together, and we consider it's your position and ours. So in terms of the position that was presented on behalf of the six by Catherine Ashton, we are on the same page.
I wish we had time to talk about some Russian-American and Russian-Charlottean kinds of topics here, but we are out of time because you have to go to a meeting, and I thank you for the time you've given us. Sergei Ivanovich Kislyak is Russia's ambassador to the United States. Come back when you have more time.
I will. Thank you so much, and thank you for the invitation.
We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop.
On the evening of April 3rd, 1968, Martin Luther King made one of the most prophetic and important speeches of his life.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
The next day, Dr. King would be assassinated while standing on the balcony outside his room at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. Now, a new play imagines what Dr. King's final hours might have been like in that motel room between the end of that triumphant speech and his death. The Mountaintop is that new play. It opened earlier this week at the Booth Playhouse and explores those final hours as well as King's life and legacy and puts great demands on the actor chosen to play this iconic American.
You are standing at the edge of Canaan on a mountaintop made of dreams of men and women who have paid the ultimate price with their lives. The baton may have been dropped, but anyone can pick it back up. I don't know where in the race we are, but pick up that baton and pass it along.
James T. Alfred as Dr. King, and he joins us now in our Spirit Square studio. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you with us. With us by phone is Tom Gabbard, who is the president of the Blumenthal Performing Arts. Blumenthal Performing Arts. They've taken the last part of it off. The Blumenthal co-produced the Broadway run of The Mountaintop and is among the producers of this tour. Good morning, Tom. Welcome.
Good morning.
You have believed in this project, Tom, since almost the beginning. I know you saw the play in London. You were part of the production team for the Broadway show, now this tour. Why? What is it about this piece that made you want to not only get involved but put money in it?
Well, I was just so struck by the fact that that this play reminds us wonderfully that Dr. King was a real human being. I think so often icons like this, you know, we set them up and somehow they are more statues than they are real human beings. And what he accomplished to me is made even more remarkable when we remember that he is just like you and I. He is a person, you know, they had doubts and fears, and he rose above that to accomplish great things.
And I think that's why it's a tough job for you, Alfred, James, as the actor who portrays Dr. King, because he is such an icon. And many people in your audience were very much aware of him because they were alive and living through the Civil Rights Movement. We saw him on television. Many people knew him, marched with him. How did you prepare for that? What went through your mind when you took the role?
Well, I wanted to make sure that I avoided the trap of trying to play the icon. You know, we could easily come up and try to mimic Dr. King, the cadence and the mannerisms and what have you. But as Tom eloquently pointed out, this is a play about a real person, a real human being. And I think the task of the play that the playwright has given us is to illuminate the humanity behind the icon. And so for me, it was a bunch of watching a lot of video, so I could help with that characterization, but reading as much as I could find about him, his own writings, writings of other leaders who joined him in the struggle in the South, and so that I could find as much as I could those little kernels, the little nuggets that could help me in trying to accomplish the task of illuminating the man versus this public iconic figure that we know.
The Blumenthal has also had great success in bringing touring Broadway musicals to town. This is a straight play, only two characters, one act, no intermission, not a lot of some special effects, but not a lot of razzle-dazzle because it doesn't
right.
lend itself to this. So, and it's in the booth, which is a smaller venue. So, Tom, is backing something like this and putting it on for the season a risk?
Oh, it's a huge risk because we don't have that history, and we you know, of course, bringing this to Charlotte was on our agenda or our hopes from the first seeing of it in London. But finding the right quality partners was really the key to this, and being able to work with Lou Bellamy and Arizona Theater Company, Penumbra, the Guthrie, to bring those kind of partners together gave me the assurance that it was worth the risk because we were dealing with very high-quality partners.
We're going to talk about this play as much as we can and go into how it was created when we come back from the break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bilo Supermarket, serving the Southeast for over 50 years. Bilo offers bonus fuel perks items with the Bilo Bonus Card. Store locator, weekly ad, and fuel perks program details at buy-low.com. It's Friday. That means at 10 o'clock, it's the weekly news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show. The Farm Bill passes Congress after a two-year standoff. CBS says it will stop selling tobacco products this fall, and the Labor Department has released its January jobs report. They'll talk about those stories and more in the first hour, the International Hour coming up at 11 o'clock. And when we come back, more conversation about a very interesting play going on until March 2nd at the Booth Playhouse, The Mountaintop. We're coming right back.
Three lives can be saved from one pint of donated blood. The Community Blood Center of the Carolinas bus will be parked at our studios in University City on Tuesday, February 25th from 10 to noon.
To schedule an appointment, go to WFAE.org and click on the events button at the top of the page.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. James T. Alford plays Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in a production of The Mountaintop, which opened at the Booth Playhouse in the Performing Arts Center on Tuesday night and runs through March the 2nd. Tom Gabbard, who is the president of the Blumenthal Performing Arts Center and the one of the producers of the show, joins us by phone from Las Vegas. As you were putting this together, as you were going through rehearsal for this, how much time did you have to spend worrying about hitting the right notes for Dr. King to bring him to life without making it an impression of him versus just getting through what you were talking about, what he's trying to say, what the playwright is trying to say in this piece?
Well, that was the thing that I was trying not to distract myself with. I think, you know, it's – He had a very unique cadence, a very unique voice. So you're going to hit it as much as you can. But the most important thing was to get to the root of what he was saying, what he was about, what this play is about. And fortunately for me, I had Lou Bellamy as a leader who I've been collaborating with for about the last 8 or 9 years. Mm-hmm. And we trust each other. So he allowed me the freedom that I needed to prepare as adequate as I wanted to.
Lou Bellamy has been a guest on this program. I think, Tom, you brought him to us, and he is he's kind of an icon in theater himself.
Yeah.
He's the longtime director at the Penumbra Theater in St. Paul, mm-hmm. artistic director. And I watched the talk back after the show on Tuesday night, and one of the questions provoked him to say that the role of Kameh, who's the other person in the play, mm-hmm. He wanted to make sure that she was on an equal footing with Dr. King, mm-hmm. not some little girl character who could be manipulated. She's a strong person on her own. At what point did he come to that conclusion, that he wanted to have her play it that way?
Well, you know, the play is such a tricky play. Again, you're dealing with such kind of a sensitive material, whereas you don't want we're not interested in trying to tear down the icon or smear the legacy of Dr. King, but we want to illuminate his frailties, his proclivities. And it is important and artistically responsible to have someone in the role of Kameh that matches King in terms of hubris and his we don't want him to look like some lecherous, right. Womanizing man in pursuit of some young hot girl, but yet being someone who's able to actually put their thoughts match him thought for thought and argue her points as solidly and as powerfully as he could.
Well, one of the things that makes this play difficult to talk about, and I'm sure, Tom, that you have faced this in promoting this play here and elsewhere, is that you really can't talk about it. You can't you can't say what happens, because then it ruins the play for anybody who might come see it. But from your point of view as an actor, James, give us a thumbnail of what this night is about.
Well, first and foremost, we always have to remember that this is an imagined play. This came from the mind of Katori Hall. The only thing that we know that actually happened in this play that's factual, that is public information, is that he was at the Lorraine Motel on that night, the night before he was assassinated, after delivering the speech to the sanitation workers.
Do we know, for instance, that he called his wife?
We don't know that.
Okay, we don't know
we
that.
We don't know
okay.
that. We don't know anything. And that's what happens. He comes in. He's tired. He's waiting for Ralph Abernathy, his longtime friend and companion, to return with his smokes, with his pall malls.
We know that that happened.
We don't know that that happened. We don't know that that happened. And he orders room service. We don't know that that happened. And the maid of the hotel brings the room service, and the play ensues. Mm-hmm. And you hear a rest about, you know, 85 minutes of pretty much two titans going back and forth on their grounds and their positions and as the state of the union is.
So many people may ask, because it is a fantasy and it is an imagining of what might have not only taken place that night, but more importantly, what might have been going through Dr. King's mind. Because he obviously just came back from making this prophetic speech in which he said, I've seen the promised land, but I may not get there with you, but I don't fear any man, which tells a lot of people, and maybe it's because it's hindsight, that he had this premonition that his life would in fact be cut short, maybe not the next day, but he was under a lot of death threats.
A lot of death threats, a lot of pressure.
So what's the point of theorizing or imagining what might have happened? Because some of the things that take us to where we're going before we get there, it's hard to talk about this now, may roil some people.
Well, I think what Katori set out to do, again, is to get us to see that Dr. King and any other leader at that time or even today was not born with some cape or some special thing at birth. And these were human beings. These were men and women. This man was afraid like any person would be afraid. He got on the plane. We do know that that happened when he talks about that. He got on the plane that morning to come to Memphis. There was a death threat, a bomb threat. So they had to hold the plane, check all the bags. They had the plane sequestered overnight. You know, here's a man that was living under a great deal of threat. And quite naturally, I'm imagining he was afraid. He was dealing with opposition within the struggle, within the movement. He's trying to get people to understand that we can't resort to violence. We can't just pick up arms and fight back. We're outmanned. We're out-weaponed. So we have to – this is our only course of action available to us.
This is a play by a young playwright by the name of Katori Hall, who is also a pretty accomplished actress, I am told. Tom, have you ever had a chance to talk to her about her motivations for writing this or what she hoped to tell audiences through this fictional story of a real man?
I have met her, and really more from interviews, I've learned more about her background. To understand, this is a very personal play. Her mother wanted, her mother was in Memphis and wanted desperately to go to hear that speech, and her mother would not allow her because she was a teenager, and she spent the rest of her life feeling somehow incomplete because she had not had that opportunity to go hear that speech. It haunted her. So Katori wrote at some level, you know, from her own personal experience. She grew up in Memphis. So I think at some level, even though, you know, this happened well before she was born, she was writing from her own personal experience growing up in Memphis.
You know, as I was sitting there watching this and looking around the theater, there were a lot of older people my age, and slightly younger there, but this is a play that I know that you'll be doing school performances of, and there'll be a lot of young people in the audience, really young people who were not alive when Dr. King was alive and at the height of his power. And I remember as a young person going to see the Broadway musical 1776, and one of the things that I loved about it was that it brought these people, these founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, to life, and it took them off their pedestals. That you saw them with these fictional foibles, but they were such that it's certainly possible that they could have had those foibles in real life. You've done that with Dr. King, but the founding fathers had been dead for 200 years. Nobody knew them in the audience. It's different here because this is a guy that maybe people want to see him as a god, as a saint.
Well, you know, the question of knowing someone and being acquainted with them or work with them, I think, is two different things. And I think that's what people may get caught up in their own, which pretty much is their own demise in terms of trying to deal and handle this material. Because unless you broke bread with Dr. King and you were there with him when, you know, he was a prankster, he liked to joke around, if you were in on some of those jokes. The people that I know, that we know publicly, were as close to him was Jesse Jackson, Ralph Abernathy, Andrew Young. Those people could come and see a show like this and say, and have a sort of inside advantage and say, well, yeah, that's likely something the King would say or that he wouldn't say. But you get a lot of people from that era that may have marched with him or been around when he was around, and take their own personal proprietary position about how he should or should not be portrayed. And I think that's not what the playwright intends. She's trying to do exactly what you mentioned. Bring this material, bring this man, make him accessible, I think, to a younger crowd so we can appreciate him more for this being this peace guy.
And I don't necessarily – I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tom.
I was just going to say, I think the other thing that she does masterfully is she really explores what his legacy was. You know, we have the benefit of looking in hindsight to see that it was an incredible legacy and he accomplished so much. But in the play, he exposes his doubts. You know, have I really accomplished anything? Have I prepared my people sufficiently? Is my life really going to mean something? And at a point in time, the play happens. That's a question that you can absolutely believe he asked himself. And Katori does a beautiful job then of answering that question. And that's one of the things I admire about this play, is that she honestly has King ask that question and then delves into answering it.
And a question, why me? I think you brought this up in the talk back on Tuesday following the performance, James, that that taking him off the pedestal, showing him as a human being with fears, with doubts about his own mission in life and what he has accomplished, and has he prepared the people who will follow him, whether he dies that night or not, is something that gives hope to ordinary people to act, because we often see these people as, well, we couldn't do that because they're special, but they're not. They're just like us.
Right. Right, and when you do that, you kind of absolve yourself from your personal responsibility, and you're taking your place and your part in trying to affect change in the world. And that's one of the things I think that Katori brilliantly does in the play, is bring us back to a place through examination of this man who we thought, you know, again, like you say, this God who did all this stuff and brought us to this point now, and now it's dead. And she's like, no, it's not. It's not, because he wasn't something – he was just an ordinary person that did an extraordinary thing. And that's who we are. We are ordinary people who have the ability to bring about the change that we want to see in the world.
And unless you were with him, unless you were one of the inner circle, unless you were joined him on the marches, unless you were in the White House Oval Office having a conversation with him, President to Martin Luther King Jr., really, we only saw him on the stump.
In the public eye. Yeah.
Where he put his masterful oratorical skills to work on that stage. And you only get one shot at that. At the very end of the play, which I think makes it all the more powerful, because we have seen him through this entire evening being just like me, just like you, in a motel room thinking about, am I good enough? Am I, you know... And suddenly he gets up and speaks at the very end, and yes, he is good enough.
Am I good enough? And what am I doing? Am I doing the right thing? I remember there's a point where Harry Belafonte says, after they signed the Civil Rights Act, he said, you know, I fear that I'm integrating my people into a burning house. And see, that's the radicalization of his ideas, his philosophies, that a lot of people don't know, that I think this play is doing a wonderful job of introducing that side of King.
You saw this in London, where I guess it began its life in London for some odd reason. Why were London audiences interested in this American icon? What was their reaction, and how has it differed from the reaction this play got in New York on Broadway, and what it's getting on the road as it travels the country, Tom?
Well, it is fascinating to see that a number of American-themed plays have begun their professional life in London. Frost Nixon, it was the same thing, although that was even further, but it was written by a British playwright. Mm-hmm. But it had a six-week run. It actually was first performed in above a pub in London, but its legitimate run was for 6 weeks at Trafalgar Studios, basically an off-Broadway-type theater in London. And that's where I saw it. Was produced by a British producer, Sonia Friedman, who I'm friends with, who is beginning to do plays in New York. And so I saw it in London during that 6 week run, and wrote Sonia and said, Sonia, you need to bring this to the States. And at whatever time you're ready to do that, if we can help with the financing of this, we'd be very honored to do that.
When it came to New York, one of the criticisms leveled at the Broadway show was that it was too big. The house was too big, and the play is an intimate play. And I think the booth is a great setting for that because it puts you right up close. You're almost in the room with Dr. King. The other criticism was that, and I've forgotten who did the original parts.
Sam Jackson and Angela Bassett.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that they were stars. And so you took a while to see past them as stars and to the characters, whereas we don't know you. And so we take you at face value instantly when you walk on the stage. You are Dr. King.
Mm-hmm. And Sam Jackson is 60 years old, too.
Yes.
You know? But, you know, that's a different kind of model, different machine. The whole, you know, Broadway thing, you need someone of his magnitude to sell tickets,
yeah,
too,
right?
Because there is a business side of it. But I think what Lou Bellamy did with me and Erica was to try to, you know, get people that would be believable at the moment. You know,
this is something that older people who lived through the civil rights movement I think will enjoy and should see, and certainly younger people who don't know him from anything other than "I Have a Dream." That speech that he made. It's The Mountaintop through March 2nd at the Booth Playhouse. James T. Alford plays Dr. Martin Luther King. Tom Gabbard, the producer and president of Blumenthal Performing Arts. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.